So there were some good years in the 70s. There were There was a good year or two in the 80s. So at what point did you think, I might want to own this thing someday?
Oh, I started dreaming about it in the 70s.
Robert Kraft's path to running the Patriots was a long one. To truly appreciate 25 years of Kraft ownership, one must understand just how unstable things were for the franchise in its previous 25 years, when nothing seemed to go right.
Kraft rolls out to his left, looking to pass. Back across his body, he fires, intercepted by Jake Scott at the 20. Scott is down at the 17-yard line. The pass was intended for Russ Francis, and Scott made the interception, and Miami has it first down at the Patriots' 17-yard line.
Most people my age growing up were Giants fans, even when the Patriots were formed. But I think them going into the actual NFL, that was kind of a seismic moment that they were part of the National Football League. Still, they weren't very good, and they're still playing everywhere. You know, I don't know. I remember the Fenway days, and then you had the Harvard Stadium and BU, and they're playing a home game in Alabama and all this. They were such nomads and just not part of the culture. And the Red Sox were starting to be regularly contending. Of course, the Celtics were never out of our minds because they just went from one championship group to the next. And, you know, Red built two more championship teams in the 70s. And, of course, the 70s were owned by the Bruins. Everybody knows that. Bobby Orr, you couldn't get a ticket. That's what we watched, Channel 38, the whole thing. So the Patriots were number four in a big way the entire time that the Sullivans owned the franchise.
Boston Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy is one of us. He grew up here, and he remembers the good, the bad, and the mostly ugly days when the franchise was owned by the Sullivan family. Former Pats GM, Pat Sullivan.
You know, the first 6 years of the franchise, we actually had pretty decent teams, and we were pretty competitive in the old AFL, and those games were very exciting, and it was fun to be part of that. And then, you know, we went through a series of losing seasons, 68, 69, 70, and it was great to actually see this thing sort of slowly come together and mesh the way it did in 76.
Third down and 18, 19 for Oakland at the Patriot 28. Stabler is back to pass. Here comes the rush again. He gets it away, and the ball is incomplete at the 5-yard line. A penalty marker is down. I don't know if the Patriots are going to be called for roughing the passer or what. And Ray Hamilton is throwing his arms in the air, roughing the passer. First down, Oakland, with 52 seconds left.
In true Patriots fashion, their best team of the first two decades was victimized by that call in a 1976 playoff game against Oakland, snuffing out their best shot at a Super Bowl to that point. A team that featured all-world tight end Russ Francis and future Hall of Famers Mike Haynes and John Hanna, they seemed poised to contend for years, but holdouts by Hanna and linemate Leon Gray submarined the 77 season. One-and-done playoff appearances in 78 and 82 were all they had to show for a group that promised so much more.
What it was not establishing with our players that we had a commitment to win, and getting our players, our coaches, and the ownership of the team all understanding that each other had the same objective. You have to have everybody pulling with the same oar. And we didn't.
From the very beginning, the Victory Tour was designed to be the biggest, the richest, and the most expensive concert tour in the history of rock and roll.
It was typical Patriot boobery, you know, right from the jump.
And it dealt a tremendous blow to the Sullivans' ownership of the Pats. Chuck Sullivan's ill-fated turn as a concert promoter proved to be a disaster for everyone involved.
This is ABC News Nightline. Reporting from Washington, Ted Koppel.
Joining us live now from Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City is Chuck Sullivan, national tour promoter for the Jackson Victory Tour. Are you a bad guy or just a fella trying to make a buck?
I don't think I'm a bad guy. What we're trying to present here, Ted, is a series of concerts, and tonight has been so spectacular, it's like a touchdown a minute in the Arrowhead Stadium.
The fact that Michael Jackson would intersect with the Patriots and have something to do with the crap stadium and the crap team was just beyond belief.
Still, they rebounded from the Jacksons and shocked the football world a year later.
And the Patriots are jumping up and down because it's down under the 30-second mark, and that means it's just going to burn out. That means that the Patriots are indeed the champions of the American Football Conference of the National Football League, opening the door to the Super Bowl in New Orleans, Louisiana,
in just 2 weeks.
The surprising run in 85 led Billy Sullivan to alter his course. He had quietly been exploring a sale of the team, and Robert Kraft was all ears.
We're in a business, in our basic paper and packaging. You always got to think, how do you differentiate in a commodity kind of business? What do you do to get an edge or do something special? And that's what we started thinking about with the Patriots. And I actually spent time chatting with Billy Sullivan and I said to him, if you ever sell the team, you know, I'm a local guy who would love it and keep it in the area, and always tried to do everything I could to stay close to the situation. You know, we had a chance to buy it early in the 80s for a lot less money than we eventually paid. But I have a thing. I do something when it feels right. And even doesn't matter what the number is, if my nose says this thing just doesn't feel right, we don't do it.
Walter Payton, Mike Ditka, hungry Chicago, finally champions on this January day in New Orleans. 46-10, the final.
Disaster. And then a day later, Ron Borges, God bless him, splashes down with this all the drug infestation in the Patriots household. So it comes out a day later. Now they've got disgrace on top of disgrace because they get humiliated in the game and then the drug stuff comes up. So even in their great moment, they managed to be somehow Patriot follies once again.
It had always been one step forward, two steps back for the Sullivans. Finally, in 1988, the string ran out and the family business was sold. Into the breach stepped a football neophyte.
Hello, I'm Victor Kiam. I used to be a dedicated wet shaver till my wife bought me this Remington M3 electric shaver. I was delighted and impressed. So impressed, I bought the company.
In 1988, Kiam's first year in charge, the Patriots went 9-7 before going 12-36 over the next three seasons. As bad as the team was on the field, they were worse off of it.
Recently, it was reported that Boston Herald sports reporter Lisa Olson was sexually harassed in the locker room of the New England Patriots. The ensuing brouhaha has pitted newspaper against newspaper and led Patriots owner Victor Kiam to reportedly declare that she was a classic bitch, and I'm quoting.
Classic is not a common word that I use in my vocabulary.
Even Saturday Night Live piled on.
Hello, I'm Victor Kiam, owner of the New England Patriots and Remington Shaver. I'm the guy who bought the company. And I'm proud to announce a new member of the Lady Remington Razor family. Introducing the new classic bitch shaver.
Kiam was only too happy to hand over the reins to James Bush Orthwine in March of 1992.
I believe strongly that to succeed, a business must be profitable. If an enterprise doesn't make a profit, it's either called a charity or bankrupt. What's in it for me? The satisfaction of and the experience. This is I'm eventually going to end up in St. Louis. I make no bones about that. But it's a fine experience for me in the meantime, and I feel I'll be doing a whole lot of good by stabilizing the difficult situation here.
With 1 foot in Foxborough and one in Missouri, Orthwine took over. And to his credit, he gave the Pats instant credibility by hiring Bill Parcells as head coach. But the new owner was just a placeholder. As he recalls in an anecdote with Kiam, Robert Kraft was waiting for his chance.
I'll never forget, before we bought the team, there was a rain at the stadium. It might have been a preseason game or something, and he was all dooted up in a suit and his hair. You know, he came into our office or something and said, I was sitting in my suite and it leaked and ruined his hair. You know, his hair was all dripping down. And it was like, okay, maybe you should sell us the team then.
Robert Kraft had dreamed of buying the Patriots in the 1970s, but it wasn't until the mid-80s that he was able to lay the groundwork to make his dream a reality. Pats founder Billy Sullivan had made a number of bad investments in the decade, and by 1985, he was seeking a buyer for both the franchise and its Foxborough home. Among the interested parties was Kraft, but something soon got in the way. The team on the field was winning.
When the team started playing well in 85...
The Patriots are indeed the champions of the American Football Conference of the National Football League.
Which is probably what caused Billy Sullivan to back away from what Robert was willing to do then. When that happened, I think Robert really figured out, you know, no one knows, but the key to this, the economics of this deal are owning the parking lots.
That's the time when we realized how complicated it would be. And, you know, some families, like if you look at the Steelers and the Giants and the Bears, I mean, the team's been in the family almost 100 years. Sometimes you never get a chance.
He realized there was even something more critical, which is the parking lots, which were owned by a group of local business people.
There were about 12 guys, and they were really into the racing community. They loved racing, and the track was here in the stables, and a lot of the jockeys lived in the trailer park that was here as well.
In its heyday, the Foxborough Raceway drew crowds that could rival the turnout at a Celtics playoff game and generated single-day revenues in the area of $750,000.
Robert Kraft wasn't interested in the horses, but he did want to harness the parking lots sitting on 300 acres of land surrounding Sullivan Stadium. All of it was owned and controlled by the raceway, and as Jonathan Kraft recalls, nothing could happen in the stadium without the lot owner's permission.
When you're sitting in the middle of a city, parking isn't an issue, but when you're sitting in Foxborough, Massachusetts, if you don't have the ability to park in those days, call it 15, 17,000 cars, you're not going to be able to do this. And he had to get the parking lot owner to agree to open and then get permission from the town. And without that, the stadium and the team are worthless because no one, at least in this location, because no one's coming.
The Sullivans' finances continued to deteriorate. Following a corporate takeover led by Billy Sullivan's son, Chuck, the team suffered a number of losses in the courtroom after being sued by early stockholders. It was Chuck who would ultimately sink the Sullivans when he decided to invest in the Victory Tour, featuring Michael Jackson and his brothers.
At Michael Jackson's behest, Don King was demoted and a new promoter sought. And with weeks to go, the owner of the New England Patriots guaranteed almost $40 million and took on
the logistical equivalent of trying to do 12 to 14 Super Bowls in 5 weeks.
The tour was a bust, and by the end of it, presenter Don King was blasting Sullivan for not being able to make payments.
Mr. Sullivan failed to produce the $24 million guaranteed letter of credit. The Jacksons continued to go along with it regardless. He undertook a monumental promotion. It was, he's a big boy, he's educated, he understands what it's all about, and when you lose, you must lick your wounds and do just like anyone else, go to the next one.
Payments were an ongoing problem, and in early 1987, after failing to make their lease payments, the Sullivans lost control of the parking lots. Kraft would acquire a lease and an option to buy the property. The Brookline native had made a play, but he only had one piece of the ownership puzzle. Next was getting the stadium, which was in bankruptcy thanks to the Jacksons.
Most people go into this and they think, I'm buying a football team. And because when the Sullivans got into financial duress and because the NFL had a debt ceiling on the teams, they redid the lease between the team and the stadium to effectively suck all the revenues of the team out through the stadium.
After the Michael Jackson tour, you know, when the stadium went bankrupt and Chaim owned the team, we outbid him for the stadium. We then control all the revenues of the stadium except for tickets.
One of the other things, though, when you say all the revenues, and my dad, he forgets one other thing. He and some partners had bought Channel 7 and the old WHDH radio back in the early 80s.
850 WHDH, where the fun never stops.
WHDH, Boston.
What Billy Sullivan had done before they owned the radio station was when cash got short, he had sold the radio rights for 10 years for an upfront amount of money. So Chaim actually was giving his radio rights to us for free, too, in those days. So Chaim bought a team but literally got no revenue from it.
Everywhere he turned, we were popping up.
By November of 1988, Kraft had the lots and the stadium and much of the revenue in Foxborough. He was now closer than ever to buying the team, but it was far from a sure thing, with a healthy amount of risk involved.
Was there ever a point where you were at all nervous or worried that you wouldn't end up with the team? You just have all the other surrounding
stuff? Our risk, the operating covenant went till 2001. So when Orthwine wanted to sell, our risk was. Someone paid such a huge price and just remained there and paid us, and then they would have been free to do what they wanted in 2001. The other risk we had, given what happened with the Colts.
Looked like a scene from an old mystery picture. A fleet of large moving vans in the rain at the Colts complex in Owings Mills. And inside, Coach Frank Cush directing the project of heading them up and moving them out.
How they moved in the middle of the night from Baltimore, you know, to Indy. We had a system, a legal system, where if that went on, how we were going to get an injunction. But we had to have people... I don't think we've ever said this publicly, actually, who were viewing the situation all the time during this period so that if we had to go to court, we were prepared to do that.
Next time on Kraftwerk.
I had told my sweet wife that what we're going to pay, and the first thing she said, you know, it's the summer house in my name.